Hello and welcome back to the show. I'm Sheen, your host, and today we have an incredibly funny guest who came all the way from India. Please join me in welcoming Prashasti Singh. Hello, Prashasti.
Hi, Sheen.
How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me here. Thank you for making time for me.
No, thank you for making time on your very busy tour, comedy tour. But you know, the reason I really wanted to speak to you, as I mentioned to you, is I watched you way back on the first season of Comicstan.
Oh my God,
2018. I was still a student at uni and I remember watching it and you were so memorable for me. I've always followed your journey since then. But I think we have so much in common in the sense that, you know, we come from like very small villages. I come from Mauritius. You come from Amity, which I didn't even know about. And then I Googled it. And then we all went into this, like, you know, becoming nerds, going to university, training, and then corporate life, and then decided that's not for us. Yeah. And we're both equally funny, I've heard. I've heard.
Yeah.
We'll see today.
I think you're funnier. You have an eye for funny.
Everyone's heard. But please tell us a little bit about you.
Okay. So I think, as you said, that I grew up in Amity. And I grew up in a factory township. So education was a big deal for everyone. You know, we were in a small town, but everyone was actually, most people around me were engineers or doctors. So education was a big thing. And I think my parents were actually, you know, very progressive in the sense that for them, you know, the girl child or boy child, there was no difference. So they really made sure that I get top quality education. And I was doing well, so they kept investing in it. So, yeah, I wanted to get into IITs and I just missed it. So I went to a good engineering college. Then I went to an IIM just to compensate for the fact that I didn't. So IIMs are the management schools in India, which are supposed to be very coveted. And then I was doing a marketing job and I was very happy with the job and I really thought I've really found my calling because it was all good. But of course, throughout my school, college and even, you know, university, B school, I always had this thing that, okay, this cannot be it. Even though I know I am someone who's into academics, who's going to make money in the corporate sector, there's a part of my life that should always be, you know, not this. So I would always be on stage, okay? And I never did speaking on stage because I was very scared of the mic, okay?
That's crazy.
I can't believe I'm on the mic all the time. But I really was. Okay. I could do dance. I could do theater where you don't have to look at the audience. But I just could not do this. Okay. Mm. But that parallel life was always there. And I think in retrospect, I feel the one thing that has really delivered for me in life is that I think I really, in the sense that every time an opportunity comes, every time people say, you want to try this? And I'm like, you know, why not? I keep dipping my feet into different things. And of course, sometimes that has a cost also.
Of course.
But so that is how life was, and I thought that is how life will be. I moved to Mumbai, and my job used to be fairly hectic, so I could not do proper theater or proper dance at that time. So I started doing improv classes over the weekend, like people join, you know, salsa classes again, just to keep this part of me active. Mm. And just somehow through that, I met a community of people who were doing open mics, and all of that was supposed to be like, say, 10% of my life, but it so happened that Comicstan, the comedy hunt, was happening around the time I was trying this. Okay, this was my first year of trying open mics, and they were scouting for talent. And someone told me to apply. I applied. I got a call, and when they actually called me when the audition happened, I was like, you know what? I'm just doing this to see where I stand. I never am going to, you know, get into this. Also because I was working in television, and a part of my job used to be working with reality TV, and I was like, you know what? These reality shows are just farce. Okay? Just selling weird fake promises to young people. I used to be that person.
Yeah.
That, you know, money. People get educated, they make money, and everyone else who's not focused on their, you know, padhai likhai on their academics should suffer. Okay, so, talent is a very rare thing, and these
artists reality go shows, hungry.
The reality shows, they just sell dreams, and then no one is tracking who is doing how. So when these guys called me, I told them, I'm like, you know what, I can't quit my job to do this. They said you have to be here for 2 months to shoot for Comicstan. I was like, I'm not quitting my job. But they were like, you should really take it seriously.
Oh, you were meant to quit your job to do Comicstan.
So they told me to, no, the team told me, the people who were making comics, then, that we need you for 2 months.
Okay.
And it can't be a part-time thing. Yeah, because, you know, you will be
put up
on a place. Mm. You'll be shooting continuously. So they were like, see how you can manage it. Mm. And I was like, I'm not quitting for sure.
Mm.
But I just, you know, I was like, you know what? If this has come so far, let me just see if I can get a sabbatical to try this. And I very casually applied for a sabbatical because I also did not want to, you know, start dreaming about something which is impossible, because I was so committed to that life. Plus, this is also a time when, you know, I was sort of the primary breadwinner of my house.
Yeah.
I was already turning 30. So I was like, I'm in no place to experiment. My family sort of depends on
responsibilities.
Me.
Yeah.
I have responsibilities. So like, I don't want to emotionally be in this weird state where I like to do, you know, now I've made it impossible for anyone to be happy. So I casually applied for a sabbatical, and it was I just put a mail in because my boss told me he doesn't have a problem, but because I was working in television and this was also in a way an OTT show, there could be a conflict of interest.
Oh yeah.
So I had to put an application, a mail to a legal team which I had no access to. They're sitting in some other geography. So I just put it out in the universe and let it be. And I had these 10 days where I had to go back to them and say if I'm coming or not. So long story short, those 10 days passed. On the 11th day, when I had told them maybe I don't think I'll be able to do comics then, the revert comes and they're like, your leave is approved. So I just called those guys. I'm like, you know what?
It was meant to be.
Yeah. Like, I think there's few moments in life when you're like, you know what? How can I not believe in destiny or faith?
It just works out, right?
So this is how it happened. So I got my sabbatical short for comics time. My plan was, this is my, you know, this is my 2 month vacation and I have to go back to my job.
Vacation.
Like, you know, because again, I'm not supposed to get into this.
Yeah.
But then I think in the process of shooting for this show, when I was putting all my energies into it, I found this resonance. Okay. I never in the longest time had not felt this correct. As if this profession, this thing that I'm doing, this is what I'm meant to do. The last time I had felt that was when I used to do maths in class 10th. Okay?
Wow.
And after that, like 11th, 12th, or my engineering, I've always been somewhere in the middle. I've never been brilliant. So here, I could feel a spark of brilliance. And that, you know, that kind of spark doesn't even need validation. Like, probably that spark that I feel has still not taken fruition in the world.
Mm.
But I could feel it. And I'm like, I need to do this. And I was like, oh my God, now what? Okay. If I quit my job. Because, again, no one was sure that Comic Stan will work. It was an experiment. So we shot. I went back to my job. And now I'm sad.
Yeah.
It's as if you went on a vacation and had an affair. Okay. And now you don't like your marriage.
You're like, why am I back?
Yeah. This is where I was really torn, because I was like, this thing, you know, if this doesn't work out, I have lost my, you know, the kind of connection I felt with my job. And I don't want to be one of those people who are miserable at work, because I really used to be a person who was motivated. So I, you know, for 6 months I was sad. Then Comic Sans came out and it was, you know, it really made a difference. Okay. A lot of people saw it. A lot of people messaged me, mailed me. A lot of people. And there was a lot of demand for us.
Yeah.
Okay, many of us. So that is when I realized, this happens to very few people. That something you like becomes monetizable for you so easily, so quickly. And the people at work also are very supportive, because I was very scared. And people at work, my bosses told me, you know what? We don't think you're funny, by the way. No, not because they're not seeing the content.
Yeah.
And my office has to be a very different person.
Yeah, of course.
So they're like, we can't believe you're funny. But
where do you keep that?
But they were like, you know, if you want to go and, you know, take this risk or take this leap, you go ahead.
Mm.
Worst case scenario, our doors are always open. And that made a huge difference. So I'm very thankful for being in that place and working with people who are so understanding. So that was it. Like, you know, it just, things kept, it really is something that really happened to me. But I think the only contribution I made was I yes-and it. You know, when the opportunity came, I was there to be like, you know what? I know this doesn't happen to many people. Let me just take the leap.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And then there's been, thankfully, no looking back. That's what.
Okay. So much to discuss here. And also for people who don't know, Comic Stan was on Amazon Prime,
yeah.
And it was a semi-reality TV, was a competition for budding comedians of India. And you were top three, right?
I don't know
how you didn't win that, to be honest. I was mad. Don't tell them.
No, I think because in my head, the conflict was something so much bigger and different.
Yeah.
This did not make a difference. I was just happy to be there and to be performing.
To get that switch, right?
Yeah.
For you, that
was important. So when people kept telling me, we really rooted for you and you were, we hoped you would be number one. I'm like, you know what?
I won.
Yeah. I already won. You guys are talking to me. People, random people reaching out to me.
Yeah.
What else can I ask for? Mm. So, yeah.
No, but I think it's also super important that you touched on the fact that, you know, not always is that you throw it all away and you're like, let me just jump into it. It was more of a very calculated move, right? Because a lot of us have responsibilities. And also when you've invested so much time and effort, and as you said, it's a lot of unlearning, right? We grew up knowing you need to get a job. Then you're taken seriously in society.
Safety, security, you know, something that promises something over a longer period of time than this just one spike and then you're gone.
Yeah.
So this is part of our ethics somewhere. Okay, so.
Yeah, and I think now more and more, I'm sure you're seeing it as well, a lot of people are unhappy with their jobs, but it takes a lot of courage to break out. And you're right, like we were lucky, we were given a lot of help. It was accelerated, right? Yeah, the move into thing, especially for you. On such a national level, you got pushed into it. So I'm really happy. Obviously, you're never going back to work. But since then, what has been, I'm sure it's not like a straight path, right?
Oh,
it goes up and down.
Oh, yes.
So how do you deal with that mentally now?
Oh, I think it's a very good and a very relevant question because when I got into it, I think my main concern was, the money, the opportunities, how consistent they're going to be, will I be able to sustain myself over a longer period of time? Is it going to be one wave and then I'll be irrelevant? N number of questions were there. But my learning has been, of course, those questions are very relevant. But I think if you do it for a couple of years, you find the rhythm.
Mm.
You figure out how the cycle works in the sense that, for example, all of us who do comedy in India, we know that there's one season where there's a lot more work.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is one season, probably typically the summer, mm-hmm. where, you know, there's the cricket matches, it's exam time. So the live show season sort of dries up a bit. Mm-hmm. People, when the March end, when the financial year closes, a lot of corporate and college shows, stop happening for a few months.
Right.
So in a couple of years, you understand this rhythm that there's one season where you make a lot of money.
Mm.
And there's one season where you sit down and write probably. Mm-hmm. But the bigger challenge, I think, is to, keep your head sane, because you understand that money probably will not be a problem if I plan things properly, because this is supposed to be time for seeding, this is supposed to be time for performing. But in the months when you're not performing or when you're not actively earning money and you have to be your own boss, that becomes a huge challenge. Because then this new type of questions come into picture that, oh my God, how can I be so bad at disciplining myself?
Mm-hmm.
People my age are achieving so much more, are so much more productive through the day. My friends, who are working, who have kids, as women, they're juggling so many responsibilities and still making it happen. And I'm just sitting at home thinking, and I'm not able to write one line. How do I feel good about myself?
Yeah, that guilt.
Yeah. So there's so many mind games that, people like us who come from very typical academic and then corporate backgrounds, we don't understand that there's also a certain amount of privilege in being directed all the time. Like, a part of your brain is sane because it is not engaging in all these self-destructive thoughts, because even if you're angry, you're angry at someone else, right?
Mm.
There is a boss you can always blame.
Yeah.
But when you become your own boss, your brain can really become your enemy.
Mm.
There are these things, and there is, of course, the imposter syndrome, all types of bad things you can think of, in those
you
months.
You take them all.
I'm lonely also now. It has nothing to do with your career. career.
Yeah. Where did that come from?
But come on, everything should come right now only. My nails don't grow properly.
My hair. I'm growing old.
Yeah. Every single bad thought. And you know, of course, it's a recorded fact how you know, people who you're writers, creators, artists, comedians, okay, they're all, you know, they have a tendency towards sadness or depression because it's in a way it's part of the job to, you know, to sit, maybe sometimes get very low and then pull yourself out of it, then get onto it again. So that has been the bigger challenge,
right?
Of course, you know, this whole task of the job is to stay relevant and to always have an audience.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different type of problem, and that is one more conversation. But that's still, you know, that's still solvable. There's enough conversation. There's enough guidance. There's enough thought process there where you can be like, you know, I need to get an audience for my next tour. What should I do? And then A, B, C, you can do those things, right? You can do a...
Try different types of content.
You can do... you can release stand-up. You can just make reels. The great thing about, you know, the content universe right now is that there's no one way, right? You can do so many things. So that is solvable.
Yeah.
But your brain has to be healthy enough to be looking for solutions, right? Not in that state where like, I think I'm done.
Yeah. Oh my God. Okay. I related so hard with this because... For me, January 2024, I quit my job to do podcast full time, right? So it's been 1 year, one full year.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you very much. So, you know, it's been this thing. I had the same exact thought process. Am I just going to be stay relevant for a bit and all of these opportunities are coming? And then what? Then what happened? There's a new podcast every day, everywhere. Everyone is competing. And good year. But again, it's like, you know, especially with us, when you're used to getting this fat paycheck at the end of the month, and now some months you make no money, none at all. And then 1 month you make double the amount, but you can't predict, right? You can't predict what this is looking like. And I remember one time my mom asked me, what do you spend most of your time doing during the day? And I was like, I manage my team. And she was like, but it's just you. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm hard to manage. I'm the hardest employee to manage.
You put it so much better.
It's true. Yeah. Sometimes that the only thing I have to do in one day is film a reel. And it's 9 p.m. and I still haven't done it.
Yeah. And I'm saying you have to understand that this is legit. You know, we... Like, you know, we all of us have the same struggle. I think that when I do this, I'm like, you know what? Am I like the most inefficient person in the world? And it's so good to be like, you know, everyone. That's everyone is in the same boat.
Yeah. And I think creativity as well, it's not the same as doing a random task, right?
Yeah.
You need to be in the right zone. Your mind needs to be ready. Your face needs to be ready. And then to get there, it might take the whole day for you to get there. But I agree. I was thinking about this as well. I used to work 18 hours a day as a consultant. Okay. And it's like constant working. And now in one day, I work 2 hours. I'm like, I'm tired. My brain hurts. What is this?
But I mean, you know, that's the thing. I told myself that in those 2 hours, you're putting in all your resources.
Yeah.
You're not doing anyone else's task or anyone else's job.
Yes, yeah, a lot of burden, right?
Yeah. And you're so much more present also in those 2 hours.
Mm.
So if you're doing those 2 hours well, probably you should not feel bad about yourself. It's something I tell myself also.
Right.
But it really needs a lot of telling.
It does. It does. But I think also... there's two things, right? Is the, as you said, the imposter syndrome coupled with comparison game.
Oh,
so we see everyone else online doing better. Everyone shows you the best thing and you're like, eh, what's happening to me? And then the second thing is also the money, the stability. Given that we are doing well, but not at a point yet where money is not even a factor, right? Where you don't think about it.
Yeah.
So then because of these two weights we carry, it's really hard to then let the creativity take over. Then you still need to start thinking, oh, but the business side of things, how do I pitch? What do I pitch? Am I pitching enough?
Yeah.
Am I convincing people? Who do I speak to? What event shall I go to? And it's exhausting. And then you're like, how is the creative going to come out then?
Yeah.
How?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I like that you made it seem like, you know, this is, everybody goes through it.
Yeah. And I think my learning has been, which again, this is something I'm trying to practice now, is that all of this will be true all the time, right? That there is no running away from it.
Yeah.
In fact, if I... If I if I grow more, this will be a problem. If I stop growing, it'll be a problem.
It will be a problem.
Right? I'll have to balance the business and the creative. Mm. And I think the only practice I've started implementing is to compartmentalize.
Mm.
Because I think what was happening is every time I sit down to write, because writing again, you know, if I don't do the creative work, it is so easy to get distracted.
Yeah.
If you're having a great day, you're in the flow, but when you're not in the flow, you know, every task, everything that you could possibly do, you know, oh my God, you know what? Do I need a haircut? Do I need to put it on?
Shall I mop the floor?
So all your admin work also starts surfacing when you are, you know, trying to write and not able to write. So now the only discipline I'm trying to practice is that there is this time where even if you get bored, even if you produce one word, this is time compartmentalized for creative work. And there is time compartmentalized for admin or business work.
Right.
And I should not, you know, I should not mix it up, because it really ends up, you know, being very inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying I've conquered it.
It's a journey. Yeah, it's a journey.
Yeah.
But now that, you know, you are very much in the public eye, right? A lot of people know you. I'm sure a lot of people recognize you. How does it feel?
Oh, I think I feel very blessed, firstly, because, being famous was never on the cards for me, never even fascinating for me, to be honest. I think it was never, in the sense that when I was, my dreams used to be that, of course, I get a great job, I get, you know, they were shallow in the sense that my validation in my head would come from my family, my peers. I wanted to be a consultant at some point. That could not happen. I became a brand manager. Then I wanted to be the best brand manager. Mm. So I was also very validation hungry. But fame was never part of the equation. It was very limited to the typical validation you get in
your
corporate
circle.
World.
Yeah, yeah.
And when fame happened, also the great thing was, because I was already 30, it did not hit me the way it would have hit me if I was younger.
Mm.
It did not, I was like, I did not think that it's a magical thing that I am doing.
Right.
That I am amazing. I really, even at that point, could realize that, oh, I'm blessed to be in this place.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to be in this place. And something great is happening through me, I guess, that people are really enjoying and loving.
Mm-hmm.
So I genuinely, since the beginning of this journey in comedy, I've always felt very blessed that when comics aren't released, and I would sit in a cafe and someone would come and just, you know, leave a note that really, you know, I'm like, it's surreal that, you know, people I don't know are connecting with me. And every time I do a show, I feel like I have 1,000 people sitting in the audience who are all me's, you know. So everything, every existential problem in my head gets resolved when I see this.
Mm.
And the great thing is that because I do live shows, I really see it physically. You know, of course, people write to me, people, you know, there's online communication. But I'm saying that physical energy of just people connecting is great.
Mm.
So I genuinely love it. And I think fame is something that I have realized that it's like a currency for people like us, in the sense that even if I feel that this is bothering me, being so on social media all the time, for example, or thinking about what people are thinking of me all the time is bothering me, I need to have an element of it so that I can sell tickets,
of course,
and I can do what I love, love to do. So I've become a little detached with this part that, okay, I need to have a content cycle. I need to be in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what I try to do, though, is that I, like, with my community, I engage as a person. But on content level, I try to give them mainly stand-up instead of giving them a lot more pieces of me, because I think at some point started bothering me. So I'm like, I can give them love, I can take love.
Yeah.
I'm very thankful, and I always express my gratitude with a lot of words and a lot of expressions.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, what exactly is happening in my house,
in
my personal life, where am I in life, I think I can limit exposing that to the world, and I can focus on churning out more and more stand-up. And that is how I sort of solved my problem with being in the public eye.
Mm.
Because I think when you're not, I think the people who are stars, they know how to deal with it because, you know, they're trained for it.
Yeah, they get training for it. Yeah.
But people like us who just like land into it, like, okay, so what?
Now what?
A part of me enjoys this also, but a part of me is really bothered. What do I do? Mm. I need to have this, but I also, you know, so it's very, it can be very confusing because of course, all of us love.
Of course. Yeah. At the end of the day, we all have a little bit of ego, right? And the reason I ask is because, for example, if one day I get recognized in public, I feel so good. It makes my whole day, right?
Yeah.
But then I get a hate comment.
Yeah.
And then it stays with me. And then that's the thing. Then my friend told me, you need to aim to get to a point where the positive and the negative don't bother you. Because if the positive makes you happy, the negative will drag you down as well.
Yeah.
So I think this is the journey. And I think you found a way of doing it where it's not associating your personal well-being and your validation.
I think even I read the comments, I over time, because this, of course, there's so many negative comments.
Oh god.
And in the beginning they hurt you a lot more because you're taking it all personally. But now I think I can read through negative comments as well as positive comments and make it absolutely not about myself but about the joke,
about the what. Yeah, the work.
And of course, the work also is my baby. So I feel personally towards it.
Yeah.
But it's much easier to deal
of
with
course.
It.
Of like course. Yeah. It's not your identity that's attached to it. And I think that's very good. And yeah, I think even creating that boundary between your professional and personal life online is something you learn over time.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Oh, yes.
Because you start to think, but this is my community. I want to share with them. But there are different things that you can share because then you can't confuse them either, right? Like, they don't know what you're showing. But I like how, for you, I know nothing about your personal life from your social media. It's pretty much just your professional life. And I like that. I think.
Sometimes I do have a question that, you know what, I get so much love, you know, maybe I should engage in a way that is more personal.
Yeah.
But I think I still have to find the new boundary then.
Yeah.
Like sometimes I feel I get too cut to cut. Like, you know, I'm just posting about my shows and then saying thank you for coming to my show. And when I see people doing that, I also get bored of them. You know, like as a community, I'm also like, okay, give me something more. Mm. But right now, I need to then figure out what the new boundary is going to be. Because when I started this journey, when Comic San came out, because all of us who became famous together, we all fell into this trap. You know, we're having dinner here, we're having drinks here, we're partying together. Yeah. Now we're partying with more popular people. We've gone through that drill.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we're like, what are we doing? This is so uncool.
It is very uncool, yeah. We all do it though.
So I think, you know, that window and that has been shut. So, but I still, you know, I'm in that process to figure out how to, you know, the optimal way to engage the community that I genuinely love and would like to give more to. Because of course, you want them to. I sometimes feel that I have a lot of opinions about things. Because with comedy, what happens is, you know, because funny is the priority. You know, the things I feel more strongly about sometimes either get diluted or get totally, totally don't get communicated.
Yes.
Because if I'm sensitive about something, or if I feel very strongly about something happening in the world, I won't joke about it.
Of course.
And because I'm committed to being funny, I don't put out serious content. So I have been juggling with this. That, you know, and earlier I used to do this actually. If I'm feeling very strongly, if I'm feeling very sentimental about something, when COVID, you know, second wave was happening, and people were dying, I would just write out these long posts, which really were very cathartic for me and cathartic for a lot of people because, you know, everyone's feeling that. But then at some point, I put a filter to that as well. So sometimes I feel that there are a lot of things I feel, and I write about them in my journal, and maybe probably I should open that conversation with my community, but I'm still figuring it out.
I mean, also having these things, right, having conversations where people get to know you a bit better is also good. But also, have you tried just like maybe capturing content of like the behind the scenes, you know, on your show?
People
would love to see that as well. I think.
So now that I'm in this tour literally started yesterday, I'm doing that in the sense that I realized, this is I'm so real behind the stage, right? And there's so many elements. There's anxiety, there's excitement. Then there's so many people who, you know, who coming with so many different energies.
Yeah.
There's an opening act who's so nervous. Okay. So and then there's so many people who help in the production.
Yep.
So that's good meat there, right there, right? That's a lot of good content. So I'm capturing that while I'm touring this
Amazing.
Time.
Amazing.
And let's see.
Okay, exciting to see. But okay, so how did you go from the Prashasti who didn't want to have a mic on stage to now doing solo comedy?
Oh my God.
So do you feel like this is like confidence, especially something that can be built over time?
Definitely. Mm. And I also feel that sometimes we don't know what our real barriers are. For example, in this case, definitely, because I've thought so much about this. And how is it that I literally would freeze on stage if I had a mic in front of me, or in my office, if I had to give a presentation, I would dread it for weeks and I would rehearse so hard. And even then, like, you know, do a bad job at the end of it. Because of course, if you're nervous, if you believe that you're going to do a bad job, you will do a bad job. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you know, these kind of things where the core thing is connection. Mm-hmm. I think in communication, okay, connection is a big part, which is something they don't teach us in schools or B schools, right? They really tell us to be prepared with information. So I learned with comedy was that my first open mic, when I was very scared that I always freeze on stage, why am I even trying this, I realized my problem actually was language. Mm-hmm. That even though I know English, I speak in English, you know, of course in corporate India the language of communication is English, in academic India also, you know, they really emphasize on using this language, but because it's not my thought language, I would not feel free.
Right.
When I'm, you know, when I'm on stage with the mic and I have, because I'm like, oh, there's going to be a lag.
You have to translate.
I have to translate, and that would make me really nervous, and that was the problem. So when I went on stage for the first time with my open mic, that barrier just broke. Because I could just transmit things from here to here. Okay? Mm. That's why my language, the language I use in my comedy is not English or Hindi. It's English and Hindi.
Yeah, it's
how I think. Mm. So when I did my open mic and I was like, oh my God, the thought is important. The purity of language is not important, right? And it's sometimes beautiful when you're speaking in a mixed up language, which is actually the language in everyone else's head as well. Like, if everyone else thinks like this and they hear this, they are happy. They're happy with the insight and with the joke. They are not policing you on, you know, how pure your sentence was in one language. And I realized, oh, that was my barrier throughout. Like, through all these years, I was always so nervous because I thought I will not do justice to either language. So when that broke, and that really
freeing,
made a difference.
Yeah.
So once I cracked that, then every time I would go on stage, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm at so much ease with the mic. You know, it was just one switch that had to, you know, like that had to go off. So my learning in this has been sometimes our barriers, you know, sometimes we have these blocks in doing things. Some people have stage fright. Some people have fear of public communication. Some people are very introverted and they can't even have one-on-one communication. Mm-hmm. I feel sometimes when you start digging deeper, your block is actually something else.
Right.
And it's a very easy solve sometimes, but you have to understand the real block, because most of the time you're trying to solve a very superficial problem, which can't be solved. Like if I feel ki mic is the problem, then I can never solve it. Mm-hmm. Right. So that made a huge difference. And in fact, now I'm trying to take it as a challenge to, you know, do a show which is fully in English.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
So as a challenge, okay, I think in the middle of the year I'm planning to do a festival run. Where I've taken up the challenge that, you know, for 1 month I'll do a show which is which can cater to an international audience.
Yeah.
And I'll most probably have a nervous breakdown there.
But hey, you've been speaking English this whole time.
Yeah, but I'm not funny in that language. Oh, yeah. I mean, see, you're making me very comfortable. Okay. But when you're performative,
oh, yeah, it's different, right?
Yeah.
Because you need to get in the zone and stuff when you're on stage.
Yeah.
So what's your prep like just before you go on stage?
For my shows? So I think now I have understood that before going on stage, there will be anxiety, and that's good anxiety.
Yeah.
So as in, now that I've done so many times, that before going on stage, I try to be really present and I feel the anxiety and I stay with the anxiety that, oh, you've come, all right, it's time for you to surface.
Mm-hmm.
And then typically someone is performing before me, I just plug myself into their act and how people are reacting. So what I do is I prep for the show in the daytime, but I think typically 1 hour before the show I stop the prep, and then of course I feel anxious, so I don't eat anything in that 1 hour. Okay. And but that's the great thing, that again, that's a great learning, that if you understand your anxiety, it can be very constructive, right? Throughout my academic, you know, academic years, every time I had a major exam, I would feel sick to my stomach.
Me too. Yeah, I would be sick every exam period. Every exam period.
Every major exam, I've been sick, and there was no one to guide us there and to tell us that, you know, this is how you should manage your body.
Yeah,
because this is all just anxiety. And I used to feel I used to feel so bad that I prepped for this exam for so such a long time, and on the day, I'm
boiling with fever.
My body's just not with me. So I really feel, if you know, as kids, we should be taught this. So I think doing stand-up is like being an athlete in certain ways, where you practice this every day so that you know what your body is telling you. So 1 hour before the show, I will have anxiety will surface. I have a ritual which we want to calm myself down and to feel this anxiety is great. This is something I need to, now this is a fuel for me to, you know, be very focused and be very present. And then I try to be in the environment. I really plug myself to the laughter that is coming in, the energy of the people. And on those days, shows are great. But on the days when I'm in my head a lot, it's not a good day.
I'm sure. But how do you take it now? You know, if let's say a show goes back, how do you bounce back?
So now the good thing is that actually, even when a show goes bad, when a public show goes bad, for example, see, the thing is, because every day I do open mics to workshop my jokes. So the process only is that some of these spots will go bad. You write a new joke.
It's testing, right?
It won't do well. But sometimes a show where you're doing everything right, where you're doing all the tested jokes, which is a high stake show, that also can go wrong, because sometimes something is off. Your energy is off, you're a little distracted, something in the room is too cold or too hot, audience is, you know, just not in the right zone. And on those days, I think the difference is that earlier I would take it very personally, and I would be like, oh my god, I, you know, if all these jokes are tested and they are good, problem is in me. And what am I doing wrong? And even after doing it so much, how can I do it so wrong? Now I feel bad for some time. I think in stand-up, whether the show goes well or goes badly, I think if you know a stand-up comic, right after their show, you should stay away from them for 1 to 2 hours, because they're in strong narcissistic zone. Okay? Like, if it's good, oh my god, I'm so great. This line I said, it killed. Oh my god, and that line, people are like, okay?
Yeah.
Or if it goes badly, we're totally in the opposite direction, but still totally, like, you know, oh my god, me, my joke, my line. So now, as I said, that because I've developed some detachment, I've developed some boundary between me and my content. I feel bad, but the process is more to do with, okay, in this line I should have done this.
What are the learnings?
And you know, maybe I should listen to it and figure out what was I doing incorrectly. And when I'm able to actually, because it's also a big task, okay, if you bombed in a show, to listen to that recording, because it's very cringe, okay? It's very cringe. Like, oh my god, why am I the only person laughing? I have a tendency, when people are not laughing, I laugh, okay?
You're like, let me fill it up for you.
Oh my god, it's so painful to listen to. And then, you know, the things I do, then I'm, you know, when it's not working, I'll speak faster than this also. I'm already a very fast talker. And then I'm like, oh my god, these words, they're not complete. Words are not complete. But you have to take the pain to do this exercise to realize, all right, I shouldn't, like, next time, even if I'm bombing, these three things I should not do. And probably I started bombing here because this one thing I did badly. Probably there was a crowd interaction where I came across as a person they don't see me as, you know, sometimes you show a part of your personality, probably you're not that person also, but it could be just one moment where the audience, full audience, like, you know what, this person we don't like.
yeah, of course.
So sometimes you listen to it like, oh my god, I don't realize that this one moment really changed the show. So yeah, the exercise is very painful, but I think the growth is in realizing you have to the exercise, right, and not go into the self-pity mode. What happened?
Yeah, always action oriented, right? Let's see what we can improve on. But now let's touch on the juicy,
all right,
stuff. Listen, when are you getting married, Precious?
Oh my god. It's as if this question, I've not heard this question in 5 years.
Oh, so you got free from that conversation now.
Yeah, I feel like there is, in Indian families, there's an expiry date. Okay, they're like and they do it gently, but in their heads, if you know if you cross 35, they're like, now, like, you know, now we have to put all our pressure on someone else, right?
Join us.
Yeah. You come here. Okay. So I think till I was like, around when I was turning 30, of course, the marriage pressure started for me when I was in early 20s only.
Of course.
But, you know, it really aggravated when I entered my late 20s, and it really was on till I was, say, 34, 35. But after that, suddenly everyone like, you know what, you are done.
You're off the list.
Yeah, like, I think in their heads, they're like, if we encourage her, then also what's the point? Like, she'll be sadder because she won't find anyone. So I genuinely feel that it's a relief that they're not, you know, they are really off my back now. I'm also sad in the sense that now sometimes my relatives call me and say, okay, now you're not getting married, no problem. And I'm like, you don't say it.
Why have you given up?
I should not be convincing you that, you know what, maybe I can.
Maybe it will happen.
No, some of them are very sweet, actually. Some of my distant relatives are very open-minded, and their way of being open-minded is, you know, even at 50, people are doing second marriages, exactly, and all. Okay, so some divorce you will get.
That wave of divorces is coming.
They're very sweet. But to answer your question, as a young teenager, or in my early 20s, I used to dream about marriage.
Right.
And
I mean, we all grew up watching Bollywood, right?
Yeah. And I think the person I was dating, I was like, you know what, when we get married, this will happen, that will happen. And I think I also made the mistake that when I became independent, when, you know, I broke up with my boyfriend who I was dating for a long time. And so the person, I was like, you know, I'll marry him. And I think I was 24, 25 when this happened, when the breakup happened. And then I flipped into this person who was militant against marriage,
right?
And I think as women we do that, like, you know what, if not this, something extremely polar. Okay, yeah. So like, you know what, as a self-respecting independent woman, I discard this concept and I'll be better than the men, okay, and I'll show them. Okay, I'll show them is a problematic, okay? Is a problem, okay, which a lot of us end up getting into without realizing it. So I think I got into that mode without really questioning that what is it that I really want. And I think it's been a great exercise over 10 years of actually figuring out what do I want. And I think I'm not averse to marriage, but I really am a romantic at heart. Okay, so marriage is secondary. I think when I find a person I really want to be around, it will be a function of what both of us feel together, right? It should be, and I really believe it should be a function of the, if you think like me, you know, my therapist told me that, you know, marriage, some people really love marriage.
Yeah.
And if your priority is marriage, it's not very difficult to get
different
married.
Different journey, yeah.
And people who are committed to being married actually are very happy even if they don't feel a lot of love for their partner. Mm-hmm. Because for them, marriage is important.
Yeah.
But for you, you know, the person you're with or the relationship you have is primary, or that is something you really, you know, that is something that you fantasize, then you have to understand that, you know, again, marriage or whatever form that partnership will take will be a function of both of you. And I really feel that. I really, so that's why I'm open to marriage, but it doesn't start with marriage, right? It starts with the person.
Of course.
And finding the person also is not easy. So that's a different story.
The number of times we've had this conversation on the podcast, right? But listen, this is what blows my mind, Prashasti, is that a lot of the women I meet, like yourself, are people who are super fun to be around, great energy, great vibe, who are very successful in their own ways, but who are struggling to find a man. And I don't get it. And all of us, at the end of the day, are romantics at heart.
Yeah.
So we don't want to just get married. It's true. If I just wanted to get married, I'm sure tomorrow we can find someone to get married, yeah. Right? That's like, open your DM. We'll find someone in there. But I think it's, why is it so hard? Because we meet a lot of people as well.
Yeah.
On the regular. Yeah. So what is happening? Where do you think that misfit is coming?
See, I think... there is a practical problem where I think a lot of us, and we are a generation of women that way, who are blessed in the sense that we have more freedom to explore not just opportunities, even explore who we are as people, okay, what our individuality is, what do we really like or dislike. But I think the flip side of it is that we can't settle. And the thing is, because men, and of course, when we speak of men, we don't speak for all men, but... But I think I also understand that if I was a man who did not have to take up this journey, right? As in, if men have not had that much evolution in the last 20 years, right? Of course, men also have evolved in certain ways. I mean, the generation of men that came before this would have been different from the men we meet now.
Of course.
But I think their idea of the kind of women they want to be with, I think that has not changed a lot, right? For them, I think it still is convenient to be with someone who listens to them, who laughs at their jokes.
This is their mom, right? Yeah.
That, you know, for them, I think they're programmed that way in the sense that you laugh at my jokes, okay? And you, of course, you be independent, you be strong, but not stronger than me.
Yes.
And that's the problem. And I think you have to also understand, we also have these biases. That, I really had to sit and realize ki I also end up liking people sometimes who... you know, who don't have a softer personality than me, right? And that's the problem. That's a problem that if you have... I have evolved in one way, but I'm very primitive in another way.
Right.
Right? I still want a man in my life. I still am... I still have not made, you know, solve this equation where probably my partner will be someone who will look up to me for guidance. Or my partner will be someone who probably will, you know, seek... protection from, you know, I will be the protector of the family, for example. In my head, I still want,
but you don't want to be that in that relationship,
So now I in many ways I'm behaving like a man, but in many ways I really want to be the soft feminine who is the guy, okay, who will, you know, who'll be there for me and who really will, you know, who'll indulge me, or who'll, you know. So that's the problem, that we have grown up so much in one way, but our needs are very primitive in another way. And secondly, I feel men in general have not had the motivation to evolve so much. Why, you know, for them it's a huge... a few months when men do that, and then you see the kind of evolution they've had, that a few men are very clear that I want a partner who is my equal. I want a partner who inspires me. I want a partner with whom I can really feel a connect, and it should not something that I just, you know, do as a status symbol or to just feed my ego. So when few men do that, you see ki, oh, this is what I'm seeking. But this species is very rare. So I mean, I think my answer to this would be that this is a problem that is not going to go away anywhere. It is, I'm saying, for a few years. Like, we have, you know, you have a blessing, and the blessing has a flip side also.
Right.
So we have to be patient, and we have to understand probably that there's a lot of love in the universe in so many ways. You know, we like this whole concept of finding love in friendship has become so big now because so many of us are so lonely. Okay.
All right, Rahul.
No, I'm saying not romantic love, but you know what I'm saying? That this, I mean, there's so much talk around female friendship and whatnot. And we've already, I've always had female friends, and they've always been supportive. But now it's a thing people talk about. Because I think we are getting into a time where, you know, this marriage or partnering up is going to get even more difficult. You know, the more your brains open up, the more you'll be like, oh my God, what is this thing?
What is this?
So I think we are, because we are the cusp generation, we are struggling a lot more. Probably the generation after us will have clarity that, you know what, marriage is, you know, like, there's a 10% probability I'll have a partner for life, a 90% probability that, you know, I'll find love in my profession, in my friendships, in my family, and this is something that, you know, like, will happen or not happen.
But yeah, I think it's so interesting because what you raised is exactly what I think, right? It's like when it comes to us, even though on the outside people might think, oh, you know, but they won't want the traditional love, they won't want the traditional relationship, the traditional marriage, but that's what we want. We're in that sphere. I want to leave the masculine aspect of me outside, and they don't think we can fulfill that. And I think that's the imbalance that's happening, which is why a lot of us are not finding husbands earlier on, because they think, oh, they're not going to fulfill all of that. And maybe that's the evolution that men will go through of realizing, oh, actually I can have both. But it's super interesting, and I think in a way is great because, you know, we didn't have the choice growing up. We had to, you know, get education, get jobs, and take our family out of whatever situation we were currently in. So it forced us to be this way, and I'm grateful we became this way because it brought us here today. But I wouldn't wish that away. But I think it's just the men need to catch up.
And the truth is, I've also realized that being honest about it, I think when I was saying I went through this militant phase where I was like, you know, I want marriage, I think that denial also is very very counterproductive.
Of course.
Because I'm saying it's so much better to say that, you know what, yes, I feel lonely. Yes, you know, being on your own and being a high achiever is a very lonely place to be in. I think a lot of women who achieve a lot, they also have a lot of shame tied to admitting it, because we have to be role models. We really are representing women in general. So I really come to a point finally to say, you know what, I do feel lonely, and I should not feel any shame in it. It's a part of me, and it's a part of me that I am not, you know, I, that probably will be with me, right? It doesn't mean I'm a sad person. It doesn't mean I'm a lonely person. But once in a while, because of the lifestyle choices I've made, I feel lonely, and it's okay. You know, sometimes it's actually a great creative force as well.
Silver linings. No, but I love that you said that. It's, as you said, it's brave to say this, because a lot of us feel like, well, this was a choice we made. So even you, even when you're saying this, you keep going back to, well, I kind of brought this onto me because there was a time in my life where I didn't want this. But I don't think we brought it onto us that way. And I think all the choices we made, and we can't go back to the younger version of us thinking we knew better than them, right? They did whatever they could at the time. And I do think that you're right. It's a lot of us now. There is a shame associated with the fact that we're lonely. But I'm like, but when we say lonely, we mean in the romantic sphere of life, we're lonely. A lot of us would want to have a family. I would love to have kids around, but it's not happened yet for us. And that doesn't mean that that void is there, and I can, and I'm allowed to be sad about that void. But doesn't mean that I'm going to rush to fill that void with anything. And I think that's how we should phrase it. And I love that you said, you know, it's something that I carry with me, but doesn't mean I'm a lonely person. And I think that is something we need to say more, because it gives women the courage to know that it's not them. It's this current problem we are all, our generation is dealing with. And yeah, I think that's so important to have that conversation. And let's see how things evolve. But I think, I think that's one way. And of course, there's the pressure. We're all desi at the end of the day. There's that pressure. And you also see a lot of marriage that are not working out. Right? I have friends who within 6 months of being married, they broke it off, because we all tend to then make bad decisions in terms, just because we're like, oh, let's get married, let's get it done. But I don't know. And I think people need to be nicer to women.
I really feel, I think every time I see my young cousins or young friends, it's very difficult to, you know, because I'm like, I feel like I should not come across as a jaded old woman now. But I really, there's one thing I want to tell them is that, you know, take your time. Understand yourself, because we're not trained to invest in ourselves or to understand ourselves. The first epiphany that happened to me when the first time I felt really sad about life, the first epiphany was that, you know, at least I'm sad, but I'm free to move in any direction. If I was married, if I had kids, and after that I had this awakening.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Then what?
I've made all these decisions because, you know, society wanted me to, or my parents wanted me to. And if I'd invested so much in all those things, and then I had this awakening that, you know what, maybe I'm a different person, it would have been much worse. And then when I started therapy, my therapist also said the same thing about, you know, how a lot of our clients are women who actually overcommitted to things in life by the time they're 25 or 26 because it looked like the right thing to do. You know, they were in love with someone, they got married with someone. But because we are women, our real development really happens when we enter our 30s because society doesn't let it happen only until that time. So then they wake up at the age of 32 and they're like, oh my God, I just don't want this life. And, you know, there are people who walk out of marriages like that. And it's a very tough decision, of course. Yeah. So if there's one thing I would like to tell young girls would be that, you know what, it looks tough. It is tough. But it is worth investing in, you know.
Yeah.
You should totally understand yourself before you take these decisions. Mm-hmm. Because life has so much more to offer.
Yeah, and when you think about it, the person we were in our early 20s.
Oh my God.
Oh my gosh. I was like, she needed so much help.
Oh yeah. I was like, oh, what was that?
What was that? And imagine if we married the people that girl liked.
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you're so right. It's important. And also 20s is so young. Like you've barely seen life. You just spend so much time in education. And then you come out and you don't even know what life is about.
Yeah. And the problem is that you're so arrogant that you think that you know everything.
I'm an adult now.
Yeah. Like, I think in the thing about 30s is that you know that you were wrong at that time, but you also have this humility that maybe I'm wrong even now.
Like, yeah.
Like, maybe I'll know something else in 5 years. So when you're in your early 20s, you just don't have that maturity. And that is true for all generations. Like, you know, we keep saying these Gen Zs, they're too confident. Yeah. I'm like, we were also...
We were the same. Very, just less very loud about it.
Yeah, we were just not exposed. Yeah. Thankfully.
Yeah, and I think also we were just discussing this, right? When now I feel like I'm faking being an adult in my 30s, right? It's like, I don't know. Do people know that I'm not really an adult? I don't feel differently to how I used to be. And I think it's that humility of like, okay, I don't know everything.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to find my way through all of this.
Yeah.
And I remember telling my dad, literally, he was here for holiday. And I was like, I miss the days when, you know, I wasn't doing taxes and I didn't have to worry about income and I was just going to school. But apparently that's over now.
Oh, yeah. This is something I relate so hard with because.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, when will I stop feeling like a child? It's a good thing, actually.
Again,
yeah. I have to remind myself there's nothing wrong in feeling like a child. It's actually growth. That you're so curious about life, you're so humbled by life, that you really feel that you don't know many things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the problem is that, you know, people expect you to behave like an adult. People expect you to, you know, I'm like, oh, I'm in this packaging that looks very old.
Yeah.
Inside is a child only.
Same. But I think that's so good because you know what they say, right? It's like when your inner child comes out, that means that you are now finally feeling safe.
Yeah.
In the life that you've built for yourself. So that's really good.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a fun question for you. Tell us, you know, what has been one of the most memorable time in your comedy career, whether it is your best joke, your best interaction, anything.
Oh, this is a tough one. I mean, let me think. Because there's so many moments.
One of your favorite memories.
I think my one of the core memories, and this is something I think probably a lot of comics, you know, will also quote this as their favorite memory would be that I think the first time you get an audience that is your audience.
Mm.
Because of course we all do open mics, we all do lineup shows in the beginning of our careers and people appreciate us, people laugh. But the first time you get those 100 people in the room who've come to watch you for an hour, you really feel like you've built a new family.
Mm.
Like, you know, you really like, oh my God, it's not about what I'm saying. They love me. You know, it's just they are understanding nuances of my words and sentences, my expressions, because they've all been me at some level.
Mm.
And, you know, because they've come and this is in the first time it happens, it's surreal because you're like, oh my God, you know, in this entire country, there's some people who watched my content and then they made this plan for me that they stepped outside their house. They took a cab, they were in traffic for, I don't don't know how long.
Yeah.
Then stood in a queue and then they're sitting here to watch me talk for an hour. What is this world I'm living in?
Right. Yeah, that's pretty special.
Yeah, that is
very special. But okay, any parting message for everyone?
Oh man, so much I have given Gyan.
you have. But just a parting message to all the young women watching you.
I think I just want to say that, you know, life is very big. And life is very big. We are meant for big things. But at the same time, everything becomes much easier if you take yourself lightly, you know. Do big things, but I feel... be light. Do not. I think we really sometimes overcomplicate things. We're too much in our head, and we really become very serious about, you know, the weight the world has put on us. All of that is true. There's a lot of weight on our shoulders. But I think just to switch into a state where, like, you know what, I'm a child of this universe, and life is so big, and I'm, you know, there's so many gifts, and I can, you know, universe has given me this gift of laughter, right? The gift of humor. I think women are definitely way funnier than men because it's our coping mechanism, right? If we don't laugh, how do we live? Okay, so I'm saying, imagine humor is built into us. That's such a blessing. So I think, because I'm in this profession also, I think about this a lot more, that, you know, to all the women watching this, or anyone watching this, of course, we're meant for big things, we're meant for serious things, but it doesn't have to be heavy. We can take ourselves lightly, life becomes much easier.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing, Prashasti. And I can't wait for you to sell out the Etihad Arena here one day, inshallah, soon. Inshallah. But until then, best of luck on your tour, and thank you for coming.
Thank you, Shein. It was so good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.